The Athletic.
Hello and welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast. I'm Joe Devine, and I am delighted to be joined today by Jonathan Dog McKenzie.
Hello.
All right, there, how's it going?
Yeah, good, thanks.
Yeah, busy morning?
Yeah, busy.
Yes,
yeah.
It was, wasn't it?
A few things.
It was busy. We were almost a little bit delayed, weren't we?
I don't think we were, no.
Because of how busy you were. What were you doing?
I was on another podcast.
Yeah,
so, yes.
That's right.
A better podcast.
That's right. Well, Steve Hankey, producer, and me, Ruben, sat through here trying to talk about the plans for this one. You were off there gallivanting, doing another. Not even one from our island.
From our country. This
that's
country
right.
of ours.
This country of ours. Now, which podcast were you doing?
I was doing the second Captain's podcast.
It is good, isn't it?
It is.
Yeah. So when can people hear you on that?
I've no idea.
Great stuff. Ruben Pinder, the baby boy, also here. Hey, buddy.
I'm not doing it. Not yet.
It's your birthday today, isn't it?
It is my birthday.
Happy
today.
Birthday.
Thank you very much.
How many candles on the cake?
27.
Good Lord. Imagine that. And such a youthful face you've got.
Too many candles for his...
For a baby.
12th birthday.
Yeah. Well, you know, sometimes... you've seen that fad of the adults who like to dress as babies? What's that called?
Adult babies.
Adult babies.
Clues in the name,
simple,
actually.
Isn't it?
The adult baby takeover is over.
Is it done?
What was that? What was that for?
Do you remember Neville Southall?
Oh, yeah.
Like, rented out his Twitter account to some adult baby fetishists.
And, really?
It went a bit weird, and he tweeted... It's over. We probably need to cut this out.
Whose laptop was that, by the way?
Sorry.
Come on, guys. This is a professional podcast. But only for 6 more weeks! Although that's not actually true, because we do have a show after that. And we'll come to talk about that today. Happy birthday.
Cheers, mate.
Thank you, yes. We'll come to talk about that shortly.
We were supposed to talk about this before we recorded, and we haven't done that.
Well,
so
we could have done that if you weren't on another...
Yeah, that's true.
Albeit excellent football podcast. You think about that while you're off the top of your head trying to plan.
It will exist for longer than this podcast.
Well, you've got a couple of minutes to think about it, because I need to tell the audience something quickly. Now, do you remember when I said last week that there definitely wouldn't be another show? And I said, there's no effing and jeffing way there'd be another show. Well...
You lied.
I lied. There is one more. But not... No, it wasn't a lie at the time. It was a truthful representation of my internal monologue at the time, my belief at the time. But as it turned out, there were almost as many people who signed up to be on the waiting list as there were seats in the venue. So the promoter sort of said, hey, do you want to do another one? And I said, well, I did say we wouldn't. But technically, if we could do it the night before... The show that we sold as the last show is still the last show. So there's no false advertising.
You sound like
involved.
Boris Johnson and the select committee
so,
trying
yeah.
to...
Let me just hold my
lie.
Thumb in this way.
I didn't lie.
No.
You've got to speak Latin. That's a problem. You need a Latin phrase.
The truth is, we were just having a drink at work. That's all it was. It wasn't a party. It was just a lot of drinking at work. Anyway, listen, there's a new show is what I'm saying. And I believe the people that were on the waiting list, I think you'll be notified that there's a new show going up. But the tickets will go on sale at midday on Wednesday the 3rd of May. At midday UK time, Wednesday the 3rd. Of May, and the show is on Tuesday the 6th of June, so it's just the night before the final show.
It's the practice for the final show, right?
It's the it'll be the shit one. Actually, it might be the good
rehearsal.
One. Yeah. It could be the good one, and then when we just do it professionally, it'll be bad, you know. Come. Thank you very much for buying tickets, by the way. It sold out very, very quickly, even though I told you to fuck off. You all bought tickets, so imagine that. Almost as though my plan worked. In its entirety.
Got them on strings.
Just wait till we bring the podcast back after the summer.
That's right. Yeah. And then they'll really pay for more tickets. But listen, we've got John McKenzie here. He wasn't here last week. And John, I don't think we actually said it on the show, but we talked about it on Twitter, that whilst the current format of the show will come to an end at the end of this season, the podcast will not come to an end. The TIFO Football Podcast is still going to exist. And it's going to exist spearheaded by... The dog himself. Now tell me a little bit about that, because we've done some episodes like this before.
Yeah, we're going to focus on dogs, actually. It's going to be a whole dog-focused
How many
podcast.
Different types of dogs there are.
All the different breeds.
Different colours of dogs.
What do you get if you mix different types of dogs?
That's right. The genesis of dogs, wolf.
It's going to be called
wolf. Wolf single-cell organism.
Woof, woof!
It's going to be called rough, rough. Yeah, perfect. Yeah. And how will it work on a week-to-week basis?
Are we still running with this this really hilarious gag, or should we?
It's entirely up to you.
Okay, well, the podcast is actually going to be an interview-focused podcast, so yeah. It will be in-depth, person to person, maybe two or three people on an episode, but
sure.
Mainly focusing on interesting aspects about football.
Uh-huh.
We're going to have a broader remit than the TIFO Talks podcast, I think, because we are going to talk about anyone who is interesting from a footballing perspective. So yeah. That can be, I guess, people who are well known for things that aren't football, but who are famous for having fandom of a football club or something
yes.
like that. But yeah, want to focus on interesting conversations about football, going having the time and space to go in depth on topics, because that's what I really like doing.
Yeah, and also it's worth saying that I think the nice broad range of themes that might exist within that show go as far on one end of saying, well, let's do a whole episode on Newcastle, for example, mm-hmm. and speak about the development of the club, which would be quite a football-y show, versus at the other end, you might speak to a filmmaker who's made a film about football, or a politician who's done lawmaking related to football, or, you know, like the whole mm-hmm. spectrum.
Yeah, and yeah. I think that's the sort of diversity that we want. We want to focus, as TIFO does well, I think, on the cultural aspect.
Don't
of football
pat us on
well.
The back, come on. That's for the audience to do.
I think that we've done a really good job
of
addressing the cultural aspect.
Have I done a good job myself?
No, you have done a good job of hiring people who are good at that.
That's actually quite true. Very smart.
Yeah, you're really smart, Joe.
Yeah.
Really
I watched
smart.
A film in the day the other day. So,
did you?
You know, while you were working.
Really?
No, you were on holiday.
Okay. What film was it?
It was The Guilt Trip with Seth Rogen and Barbara Streisand. Came out in 2012, I believe. I'd never heard of it before.
I haven't. Was it good?
It's quite good.
Yeah.
I enjoyed it. Road trip, mother and son, you know, complicated emotional tanglings, grapplings.
Yeah. I could see why you were attracted to a film that was titled Guilt Trip.
Yeah.
That is your main management style, isn't it?
And it works very well.
It does.
Yeah. Now, on the new TIFO Football podcast, it will mostly be presented, hosted by you, speaking to people that you're interested in. But the thing I like about it is that when I find someone who I could get to talk to me, this is not very often, that I could do an episode, or baby boy Ruben Pinder could, or JJ Ball could, you know, and everyone else. Yeah, even Michael Bailey could if he wanted to, Seb too. So you'll still hear from all of us, albeit slightly more infrequently. And I don't just say this as a expert marketeer or as a pretense of positivity. It will be better. It'll be different to what this show is at the moment. But it'll be really, really cool and great. And what's another positive word?
Slick. Inspiring.
Slick and inspiring. Exactly, yeah. There we go.
Do you think we should say to the audience that they should suggest people that they want on?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. No. Listen, if there's people, if there are, be they celebrities or not, be they just people who write about football or are interesting in the football space, or someone, you know, I don't know, you've got your favourite grounds person, that sort of thing, send John McKenzie a DM and let him know, hey, you should speak to this person and we'll do our best.
As long as you think that they could be interesting for more than 30 minutes.
Yeah. I think, to be honest, anyone's interesting for more than 30
minutes.
I don't
know. I've done some interviews with people who I'm...
Who's the worst one? Ken Early. He's terrible, isn't he?
I feel as though I've...
He's one of the worst.
Do you mean you've interviewed some boring people, or you have been the boring interviewee?
Yeah, I mean, don't listen to the second captain's podcast this week. I've heard there's a bad guest on. There's some people that you can talk to and you can talk to and you can talk to, and you've done interviewing, you know how it is. They go. You set them off and all you then have to do is steer them in the right directions and make sure that you're moving things along. There's other people who I've spoken to where I've been like, right, I'm going to struggle to get, 15 minutes of content.
Is the juice worth the squeeze, as they say?
The most boring interview I ever did was David Villa in 2018.
Really?
A World Cup winner over the phone refused to say anything of note at all about the Spain team or any other teams.
That's quite funny, though.
He just didn't run it.
I feel like if I was a professional footballer, I'd do that for fun. I'd see if I could get through the whole conversation without really saying anything.
That's what Michael Olise does in his post-match interviews.
Is it?
Yeah.
Well, they're trained to do that, I suppose, aren't they?
Yeah. But Olise does it without that kind of media-trained cadence of making it sound like he's saying something when he's actually not.
Right.
Like, he was asked about a last-minute winner that he scored back in November, and he went, Wilf passed me the ball, shot. Scored.
Like, it is genius.
Deadpan. It was.
Yeah. Yeah. That was the best thing about it is that like he must have planned that.
Oh,
he must have. But he kept his face.
Yeah.
Who do you think is the best person to to interview. I think Erling Haaland must be up there, right?
Yeah, he seems fun.
He's quite young, though, still. I mean, like he obviously, at the moment, he would be exciting because of the season that he's had.
You think he's going to get jaded?
He's good in-house media stuff, like that thing where he's sitting around with John Stones. Yeah, yeah. Or like his impression of Stones' accent when he's like, you're all right.
I feel like you want an older person, though, with more experience, more to say, a lifetime of anecdotes, you know.
Patrick Bamford was a very interesting chat. He and I spoke for about 45 minutes once.
Yeah. You do lovely climate change stuff, weren't
you?
Yeah. Which is already kind of an interesting topic for a footballer to be talking about.
And Jack Grealish was also lovely.
Hmm.
Do you know who'd be good? Ian McKellen. Isn't he a big football fan?
Does he not own... I don't know. He owns a pub in Limehouse, doesn't he?
Does he?
I thought maybe he owned a football club.
I think he owns one. Anyway, just thinking of Gandalf. Basically.
Hey, welcome to the TIFO Football Podcast.
Do you think this intro has been a long...
Not as long as last week.
Long
Jesus
and boring.
I'd happily hear it end now.
You want it to end now?
Yeah.
This is the problem with
that
doing
the intro.
That
makes me want to talk
first.
About it more, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Every time Steve says stop, it makes me want to go. It really does.
The perverse.
Yeah. All right, fine. Well, listen, there's loads to talk about on today's... TIFO Football Podcast. Oh, the relegation battle really hotting up. Leeds have gone and done some stuff and or are considering doing some stuff and or maybe have done stuff by the time this podcast is released or maybe not done stuff.
Same is true of me as well.
Same is true of John McKenzie.
John's shaking his head already as you say that. I haven't even mentioned the name.
There was a Leicester-Everton happened Monday night as well. We're going to talk about that. Worth pointing out that we're recording on a Tuesday morning because there's a bank holiday here in the UK today. And Arsenal-Chelsea is played this evening. So you'll be listening to this podcast after that game, but we're recording it before.
Should
so we
just preemptively cover that game and go, wow, what a way for Arsenal to bounce back from those disappointing results. Frank Lampard really left his team exposed on the counter-attack. Anyway,
that's right. Birthday boy pinned
still
him with
no,
a top
still
prediction.
No win for Frank Lampard.
He hasn't got a magic wand.
Yeah,
we can talk about Liverpool Spurs though. That was a big game that happened over the weekend. Manchester United Aston Villa will come to a little bit later too. Pochettino to Chelsea. We don't know if that's happening yet, but we're going to talk about it as though it may or may not be. And a quick glance over to Serie A, where things are really hotting up as part of the Champions League race. That race for the sweet, sweet moolah that is required to maintain. Solvency. Yes. Yeah, there we go. All right, fine. Well, for now, I will leave you in the warm hands and the cool embrace of the bitterness and the passing of time. So let's begin by talking about the relegation battle, but very specifically, John McKenzie, Leeds United. Now, here's a few things about Leeds United. Phil Hay, the Athletic's Leeds correspondent, at the time of recording, is writing or has been writing that Leeds are considering sacking Javi Gracia, the current coach.
You made it sound like Phil Hay was going to get sacked then.
Phil Hay's
like,
going to get sacked.
He's the Leeds journalist at the
time.
He's
the Leeds correspondent. The Athletic are taking the decision to sack him on account of how bad Leeds are doing. Yeah. That's not an appropriate joke in the current climate. Let's come back to that. Yes, let's talk about the relegation battle now. John McKenzie, very specifically, your beloved or behated Leeds United. Now, let me throw a couple of things here at you about Leeds United. The Athletic's Phil Hay reporting at the time of recording that Leeds are considering sacking Javi Gracia and bringing in Big Sam Allardyce. Now, that's funny, isn't it? So we'll talk about that. Also, Victor Orta, the football director of Leeds, who, you know, was part of that documentary and has been around, he's been sacked. So we'll talk about that also. And, you know, these things may or may not have happened by the time that people are listening. But it's not looking great, is it? I mean, Sam Allardyce, if it happens, the last four games of the season... What do you think?
Well, we're in a situation where if we do manage to stay up by some sort of miracle, we're going to have potentially new owners, potentially a new manager, and potentially a new director of football. So it does feel as though we're sort of staving off the inevitable and have been doing for a couple of seasons now.
Mm-hmm. I was reminded, I think, last week that last season Leeds survived on the final day, you know, just about.
We survived on the final day because we played Brentford, who'd had their Christmas party or something, or their summer party, like right. 2 days before or something, because yeah. they wanted to fly off immediately after the game to go on holiday.
Yeah.
So. But yes, those are the sorts of smart decisions that we make, you know, play against the team who are going to have their summer holiday 2 days before we play them.
Yeah.
Seems smart. We're playing Spurs. Last game of the season.
Well, I mean, will they be in the same situation? For, maybe they do. Oh. It's worth saying we should probably talk about the run-in. Let me just...
I can tell you what the run-in is.
Can you?
Yeah, we have Manchester City. Then we have Newcastle. Then we have Wham, West Ham.
Wham.
And then we
Wham,
have...
Wham, I believe
Wham. 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 Wham, as their...
Wham. Wham, as posh people say.
Yeah.
And, Spurs on the last day.
Yeah, okay. So you're going to lose...
All of
minimum two of those games, right?
Yeah, I mean, look, we're in a situation now where I reckon a win could be enough to keep us up. You have four games and anything can happen. You can shithouse a win, right?
Yeah, so, because as it stands, Leeds are in 17th place, just outside mm-hmm. the relegation zone.
On the same points
on
as
goal
Forest,
difference.
Yes.
30 points, Nottingham Forest below on 30, Everton on 29, Southampton seemingly already consigned to relegation with 24. Above Leeds, also just on goal difference, is Leicester on 30 points. Mm-hmm. And at the current time, it seems as though the 34 points that West Ham has might be enough to stave off. So really, we're talking about two of Leicester, Leeds, Forest and Everton accompanying Southampton down.
It's quite a big gap with goal difference as well.
Yeah.
It's like 11 goals between Leeds and Leicester.
Yes. And it would appear that Leeds probably have the hardest run-in of those teams.
Yeah, and not just that. It's... I mean, obviously, you bring in a new manager and hope to get a bounce. That's what happened with Javi Gracia.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk about that, because he did quite well in the first few
games. Yeah, 10 points
in
five in the Premier League.
Yeah.
Leeds ran a little bit rich in that period, and I was on Total Age saying...
Well, you got a third of your season's points in five games. Yeah, that's running a little bit rich, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Since the second half against Palace, we've completely imploded under Javi Gracia. So
yeah.
I can understand why...
21 goals conceded in April, the most in a single calendar month by an English top flight side since Newcastle in 1986, mm-hmm. aka before football existed.
Wow.
Yeah. So not good. So I can see why the board would want to bring in a new manager and sort of think, well, at the worst, we're going down as things are standing. And if we stay up, we stay up. And that's good because it saves you a lot of money. So I think there was a report, is it in the Telegraph this morning, that said that Allardyce has been offered a seven-figure bonus if he keeps Leeds up. That's for four games of management. So you're talking like £1 million.
I'll do it.
Can you imagine how smug he will be if he manages to get a result at the Etihad as Leeds manager?
Well, the thing as well is that game's this weekend, right? So they've not announced him yet. They're probably not going to announce him until whenever.
It's
not
very
starting.
Plausible that by the time people are listening to this, that it's not happening and the news is already over.
Yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
So we should bear
true.
That in mind.
Yeah, but even if things happen at an accelerated timescale,
yeah,
he's only going to get like 2 days to work with the squad.
But before. I didn't think it was about... I thought it was just about the presence of Allardyce.
Well, yeah, it is. You're at a point now where it's just going to be variance. It's almost impossible to like analyse anything, right?
Yeah.
You get a lucky goal. The opposition score a free cone goal. That could be the 3 points that keeps you up in the Premier League.
And that's what Allardyce brings.
Yeah, I mean, potentially. I don't know. He didn't do it in his last job, right?
No, he didn't.
And he had 26 games there.
That was more than four.
That's more than four, and you would think that... I'm not entirely sure how it went at first for him at West Brom, but his win percentage at West Brom was pretty bad. I think it was four wins in 26
They had a
games.
Pretty poor squad as well, didn't
they? They did, and they were heading down.
This squad has more quality in it than that one.
Yeah.
But did he quit, or did they sack him before they went down that year?
I think he has a habit of leaving at the end of these jobs. So the last few he had Palace. I think he left that job, didn't he?
Yeah, he walked away from it. It was very odd.
In the summer. And then he had Everton after that and I think did the same thing. He got them up to eighth or something. But like, the standard of that division was clearly not great
because
he had half a season, won about 10 games or something, and it was enough to get them eighth position. But
well, I suppose, like, you know, talking about Sam Allardyce, Ruben Pinder, it brings about an interesting conversation because we've said on this podcast before this season, looking around the league, the quality of manager is incredibly high in through a sort of modern lens as well. There are very few Allardyces left. And by that, I'm not making a value judgment about the quality of Sam Allardyce as a manager, more just the style of Sam Allardyce as a manager. Obviously, there's four games left of the season. Leeds need to do everything possible to try to stay up. I'm not saying that it doesn't make sense, but he's a bit of an unusual candidate in the current context.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it felt like for the last few years that the proper football men, for lack of a better term, that kind of manager, have been completely cast aside, and it's like their time's up. You know, Mark Hughes has dropped down the leagues. Pardew hasn't managed in England since West Brom as well, and that didn't go very well. So clubs have been more reluctant to take a punt on those guys to keep them up now, and they'd rather go for managers like Javi Gracia. But there's been so much managerial change this season, it feels like now all of the kind of the struggling clubs are kind of pressing the big red button and go, well, we've tried two different things, neither of them have worked, but we know that this used to work, so what harm can it do to roll the dice like that? Because the financial implications of going down, especially for Leeds, are too drastic. But so more clubs need to be run in a more sustainable way where you don't fear that your club might fall off the edge of a cliff if you go down, because three teams have to go down. Yeah. Like, you have to account for the possibility.
I think there's an element as well where if you sack your manager four games before the end of the season, there's a very limited pool of coaches who are going to be willing to take that, even with that massive bonus that is hanging there as well. Because if you're a young up-and-coming manager, you see that four games, you know that the majority of that is just variance, and it's going to be lucky, basically, if you stay up or not. It's a massive risk for you to take.
It's not
that
enough
kind of
time to drill job. In a new cohesion, really, is it?
Yeah, it's literally just either being a four guy or gambling on it working out somehow and being look.
Also, presumably, if you're Sam Allardyce and you have the, you know, you can spend every training session working on solidity, but presumably a big part of your thinking is, can I show up, galvanize this team, bring the right sort of attitude and mood and atmosphere to the dressing room and to the training ground, try to work psychologically with the team to make them feel like a bit, you know, to give that kind of siege mentality. Presumably that has to be the aim, because...
Yeah, but I feel as though I've listened to a number of different clips from his podcast and various media that he's done recently, and you talk about him having to instill a mentality, and I feel as though the mentality that he will instill won't be that galvanizing sense of, you know, we have good players here, we can make the differences. So much of what he seems to do at the moment is this sort of negative, antagonizing, you know, I can't get a job in the Premier League anymore because my name's Sam Allardyce, not Sam Allardyce. And he used that phrase, I think, in that podcast. This whole idea maybe a siege mentality, like that everyone's against us, will work. But I also feel as though we've moved beyond that point, right? I think galvanizing managers now galvanize players by giving them tactical systems.
Being nice,
putting arms around shoulders and G-ing them up, but also having those ideas that you're going to try and implement on a
Interesting that, though, is a broad conversation, isn't it? And it's good we've got a very own baby here to help us from a different generation to understand this, because I feel like there's been a shift in the way that dealing with players generally is approached. You know, 10, 15 years ago, you would shout at them and call them a and say you were going to set fire to their families, and that's how you would get them to play good football.
Whereas that's my management style.
Whereas if you were to do that now to the younger generation of footballers, I feel like that doesn't work. And what seems to... I mean, this is obviously a very broad, sweeping generalisation, but it seems to work when they're a bit nicer.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's kind of... It's like... What you're alluding to there is kind of what people like Roy Keane and Graeme Souness seem to miss. In their punditry, they always kind of talk about berating each other. Do you remember when Roy Keane once said he'd be swinging punches in a dressing room or whatever? And 20 people in their 20s aren't really generally like that anymore.
Sure.
So I'd appreciate it if you stopped doing it to me.
Right.
But it doesn't work.
You're very quick. You're always evading the impacts, you know. But.
Yeah.
Live. That's what I'd say. I feel as though...
He's not finished, John. Oh. Don't interrupt the young baby.
Let me talk.
You interrupted him.
No, but only to... A little joke to help him carry on.
Okay.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, it doesn't work. Jose Mourinho once said about Frank Lampard, didn't he, that at 21, or however old Lampard was when Jose arrived at Chelsea, that he was already a man and players aren't like that anymore.
No.
I think there was... He might have been comparing him with Dele Alli, who obviously... had a very brief upturn under Jose and then fell away because that kind of man management didn't work with somebody of his character.
Yeah.
But like Allardyce's approach has worked in relatively recent memory. Like he kept Palace up and kind of transformed them overnight. Mm-hmm. Well, not overnight because we did lose 4-0 to Sunderland. That was the worst day of my footballing life. but it did work to an extent. So it depends on the characters, but the best modern managers are adaptable to different characters. They know when to put a rocket up somebody and also when to give them a hug.
And, you know, maybe he does. It's possible that he does that.
You don't get that far without having some kind of people skills.
Of course. And I have to say, like, for me, the big upside is that that sort of negative energy gave me my favourite ever football moment, which is Sam Allardyce laughing like Santa Claus at Chico Flores, the Swansea defender who had gone down under a tackle right on the touchline. It's if you haven't seen that, I'm sure you have seen the meme, but go and look it up. It's one of the most beautiful moments in the history of the world.
He's good value for like memes and like Barclays moments. Like
so funny.
when he was at Palace, he did a little dance and kind of gave somebody the eyes when we were playing down at Bournemouth. And
well, Pardew's dance. We mentioned Pardew before. His dance, that was a terrific dance.
Yeah, Wembley. He also has been linked with this Leeds job, by the way.
Yeah. Get them all in. Get them both in. They could do it together. Oh, yes. What do you think?
No, I think no.
There's a real quite kind of pathetic tragedy to Big Sam's energy over the past few years, isn't there? Like, it's negative, but it's also...
That's really damning.
But it is.
You said that like it was a lot nicer than what
I know.
Came out.
I didn't mean pathetic to sound so
pathetic
horrible,
tragedy.
He's talking about pathos in the classical sense, people.
Yeah. Come on. Finish up, though.
He's been on, you know, beIN Sports to talk to Keys and Gray a lot, and it's all complaining like the world is against me. Mm. And ignoring the fact that football has just kind of moved beyond him. And there's an irony in that because he was one of the first people to do like data analysis to help prepare for his games and stuff. And then he just kind of stopped and football moved beyond him. Mm. But yeah, as I say, it's worked before, 4 games. Why not?
Yeah, that's interesting, isn't it? The idea of the world being against him. I know it's not against him because it's against me and it can't be against both, can it?
We've had 9. That's the rule. 9 Premier League clubs.
That's
now,
true.
Right? So Leeds would be his 9th.
Yeah, right.
Does 4 games count as a job?
Well,
it's like a contractor, isn't it?
It's 3 more than he had with England.
That is true.
Still 100% win ratio, so can't knock it.
It's a weird one, isn't it? Because
I stop you. Okay. Because I want to move you on to talk about something else related to Leeds now. Victor Orta, we mentioned at the beginning, the football director has also left the club today, as far as we're aware from news reports. Victor Orta is actually the person that some fans have been chanting about over and above the ownership. I mean, I was listening to the Athletic Football podcast that came out yesterday, and Phil Hay was making this point that, you know, perhaps it's because the fans already have the expectation that the ownership is going to change over at some point soon, and they wanted to make their thoughts known about Victor Orta. Just give the audience here a little bit of a backstory. Why are fans so upset with him?
Well, Victor Orta has been at the club for 6 years now as the director of football, and I guess very much positioned as the ideas guy, and he's always very quick to sort of take the credit when, for example, you hire someone like Marcelo Bielsa. And he's done a lot of stuff that deserves credit. I was saying on the Second Captains podcast, I think the strength.
You're going to recycle podcast material here now. Now it's got to this stage, has it? You're our guy, but you've already said this somewhere else.
I've already said this somewhere else. But the idea that I think is good behind what Victor Orta does is that he's very open to, I don't say delegation, but like other people's opinions. So he's very happy to spend money on a number of different data companies, data packages, and pay for consultancy on certain things. Mm. And that means that he has a really diverse set of generally smart opinions that he is drawing from. But the problem is that sometimes you get the impression that he has too many opinions that are circling around that he can pick from. So sometimes he'll do smart things and sometimes things will go well, but equally other times things will go terribly wrong. So he's made a bit of a name for himself for reclamation projects. So signing players who were touted as being talent and having potential high ceilings, who've maybe dropped off a little bit in subsequent seasons.
Dan James.
I mean, Dan James is maybe not my example of that, but I would say someone like Jean-Kevin Augustin, who we talked about on the podcast a few weeks ago, who is a player from Leipzig who we signed for, well, we committed to signing if we got promoted for a certain fee, got promoted but didn't want to keep him because he basically lost a lot of athleticism and was struggling with injuries and stuff. So because of this legal loophole based on around the fact that the season ended later because of COVID, they tried to not pay for that. So situations like that, I think, that have become quite emblematic of Leeds in the last few seasons, where it feels as though there's sort of smart ideas there, but then when it doesn't work out, they try and wangle things in their own way. Those have become more and more increasingly obvious, I think, since Bielsa left.
Yeah.
There's been less good stuff to placate the fan base with, and so I think what's happened is this downward spiral now where I think everything that goes wrong is now being pushed Victor Orta's way, and we say, you know, he's the ideas man, surely the ideas are bad,
right?
Surely he should move on.
Is there not also a massive decline in form since Tyler Adams got injured?
I'm never going to be the sort of person who's going to agree to like one player being the difference between where we were and where we are now.
What about Robin van Persie in 2013?
What about him? Do we think Leeds declined after he declined?
That's right.
There's an argument to be made there. It's a mess is basically where we're at now. And that's what I think a lot of Leeds fans find so frustrating, because so much of the good things that occurred under Marcelo Bielsa weren't just the product of being successful and winning, but were about having someone in the club who understood the most important thing about football is the club's relationship with the fans. The impact that a club can have on a fan base is more important than the underlying financial management or success of a club. Because if you don't have the fans, you don't have that, you don't have any concept of financial success. And I think the thing that Marcelo Bielsa did, yes, he made us enjoyable to watch again. He made it, and that's really important for a fan base. They want to watch good football. But he also got the fans able to think about the club in that sort of positive societal aspect.
He detoxified, and
he got people realizing that, you know, football clubs are called football clubs because they were originally set up as clubs of local people within the community who came together under this common idea of supporting a team.
Yeah, they're not called football corporations.
They're not, no. And I feel as though Leeds fans, as a result of Marcelo Bielsa, were able to enjoy that club aspect again. And the idea there being that there are the people behind the club have our best interest as fans at heart. They're going to make what they think are the best decisions. And it's since Bielsa's gone, it's become very obvious that that isn't the case. Actually, they were riding on the coattails of him.
Well, let's lay some context here as well. And listeners, we will move on from Leeds at some point, because good Lord. But it's worth saying that obviously behind the scenes, that there's Andrea Radrizzani, who's the current majority owner of Leeds, Italian businessman, an American outfit. What's their name?
The 49ers.
Is it 49ers Enterprise?
Yeah, there's a bunch of investors who are involved with the 49ers who have a minority share.
It's a kind of it's a group of investors. They own also an American football team. You know, considered to be generally smart and patient investment group. And the expectation was that at some point, maybe it would be this season, maybe it would be next 2 years down the line, that they would turn their minority stakehold into a majority and buy out the current ownership. Obviously, if Leeds are relegated, that is a different scenario. It's not clear whether that would or would not happen. And it's worth listening to the Athletic Football Podcast with Phil Hay to learn more about the details of that. Very interesting. But I suppose I guess the question I'm asking is, with Victor Orta having been there for 6 years and now departing at this point, four games before relegation or not, it seems like an odd time to sack a football director. I mean, that's clearly more of a symbol than anything else, right? You might as I mean, I guess unless they're thinking they want to get ahead of things in the summer, but they don't even know what league they're going to be in. So it's not like they can really do any transfer business between now and the end of the season. What's the point of sacking him today instead of 4 weeks' time if it's not just a symbol to the fans and or it's a decision taken by a group of people who might be taking over soon? This is just speculation.
The timeline of how the news broke was that Sam Allardyce was going to potentially take over from Javi Gracia. That came out before the Victor Orta news. As soon as I saw that, I thought there's no way that Victor Orta would suggest that as a sort of managerial pathway,
right,
which made me think already something's happened behind the scenes which suggests he's going to end up moving on. So I think they're sort of burning everything down. I think they're desperate to try and keep the club in the league because it will retain a certain amount of value in terms of the ownership takeover, right?
Yeah.
If the club goes down to the championship, it could very well be the case that takeover still happens, but it will be at a much more reduced rate. Mm-hmm. And I feel as though that's what's happened in the last year, right? There's been this insinuation that the value of the club has been dropping and dropping and dropping, and Andrej Radrizani is doing everything he can to try and keep the club in the league because that's the big drop that makes all of the difference. So it feels now that it's sort of desperation levels, right? I think they made decisions too late a lot. They sacked Jesse Marsh. You can argue whether or not Jesse Marsh should be sacked at all. That's an argument some people make. I think that he was taking us down either way. Mm-hmm. I think the big problem there was that they kept hold of him until after the January transfer window. Now we have this squad which doesn't fit a manager who's trying to keep a team in a division.
Yeah.
And so there's issues there. But it feels as though everything that has been done now has just got to desperation level. So it's like, well, this hasn't worked. Let's bring in a new manager. Oh, that hasn't worked. Let's bring in another new manager. Let's get rid of the director of football because he's the ideas guy. So someone has to take the responsibility here. And now we're going to get into this summer either in the Championship or the Premier League without a manager, almost certainly without a director of football, and potentially with new owners,
and potentially not, right? Which is
equally damning. Yeah. So it's very hard to see this season as anything but like an absolute and utter disaster.
Did you
for
see during the defeat to Bournemouth at the weekend?
We should say Leeds lost 4-1 to Bournemouth. Yeah. We don't think we actually said that, but I think that's why these things are happening. Something was cut. We should say before we move on, Steve Hankey put this in the podcast plan for us there. Allardyce did not leave West Brom before they were relegated. This is from the BBC on his Premier League record as well. Allardyce's last spell in charge in the division was with West Brom in 2020-21. However, he was unable to save the Baggies from the drop after replacing the sacked Slaven Bilic and suffered his first relegation in 17 seasons. His managerial record in the top flight currently stands at 537 matches with a 33% win rate and an average of 1.26 points per game. Now, that would probably be enough to keep Leeds up, wouldn't it, if it worked like that?
That's why I thought he had left before they went down, because he had done that previously, and that was his first one. I bet he hates that he's got one relegation on there.
He's got one on there. Well, you know, he's still got the Leeds job, so there we go. 1.26 points per game. Look forward to Leeds finishing the season on 35.26 points. Hey, it's going to be very exciting, and hopefully enough to stay up. Let's have a break now. When we come back, we'll talk about Leicester, Everton, two other big teams that could be facing the drop this summer.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Yes, returning to the second part here of the TIFO Football Podcast, all above board, Leicester City 2-2 Everton. What a shocker. Hey, 1 point apiece, not really any useful for either of these teams, both in the relegation zone there, though. Nice goals from Soyuncu and Vardy, Calvert-Lewin and Iwobi, and a missed penalty, of course, as well. For Leicester, I believe there was a missed penalty.
Yeah, Maddison put it down the middle, and Pickford's water bottle was later shown to have where Leicester's possible takers would put their pens, Vardy, Maddison and Tielemans, and next to Madison's name it said stay with a big 60% green thing in the middle of the goal.
Wow.
And I really liked how Pickford, he moved towards one side of the goal just to kind of convince Maddison that he was going to go that way, and then immediately moved back and just punched away. It's good.
Do you know what my favourite thing about penalties is? Whenever someone saves a penalty, everyone on Twitter's like, oh, that's the worst penalty ever.
Right.
I just think it's so funny because like most of the time goalkeepers are just guessing. Like,
is that your favourite thing about penalties, or is that your favourite thing about people?
Maybe people.
It sounds like
Twitter,
a people thing rather than a penalties thing. But
I thought with Maddison, like, so Mohamed Salah the day before had scored a penalty, right, where you just put it down the middle, and no one's been like, oh, you know, that's a shit penalty.
Everyone says it's good.
Everyone's like, good penalty.
Calvert-Lewin went down the middle. He leant back as well, and it kind of didn't look like the cleanest one. It you know, different day could have gone over the bar. Nobody said that was a bad penalty.
I mean,
sure.
Obviously, if you're putting the ball down the middle, you have to make it look as though you're going one side or the other.
Yeah.
But obviously, in that situation, Pickford has just been told, stay in the middle. He's probably going to go down the middle. And that's what he's done. And that's he's just kicked it straight at him.
Well, right. History is written by the victor, isn't it?
It is. It is very much.
And,
yes.
You
and
know,
the penalty takers.
And that's why I believe in... Not that one. No. Trying to think of a good clean history joke. That's why I believe in the formation of the European Union, because it hasn't worked. My joke hasn't worked. That's why I believe in Stonehenge. Does that work?
You believe in Stonehenge.
I started in a good place that was not speakable, and then I moved further and further away.
Which is your favourite henge?
I like the town of Henge.
Penge.
Yes.
That's in South East London. What is Penge. A henge?
It's a stone's...
I know what Stonehenge circle. Is, but...
Yeah,
that's just a great example of a henge.
Never heard the word henge without stone before.
I think it's
it.
Just a stone circle, isn't it?
Okay.
I'm actually not... Yeah, henge is a prehistorical circular or oval earthen enclosure.
Yeah.
Dating from around 3000 to 2000 BC during the Neolithic, also known as the New Stone Age and the Early Bronze Age.
Do you know what I like about henge and stone circles? Is how they always say, the thing that they're always impressed by, the modern people, is how they align perfectly with the stars. And I think, what? You mean the stars that you can see every night? Do you mean the ones that you can see to align them with?
Isn't the more impressive thing about how they moved the stones?
Oh, sure, that's impressive, yeah. I'm not trying to take away from those prehistoric peoples. And just if any prehistoric peoples are listening, apologies now for if you were offended by that. I didn't mean to take away your achievements. You lifted some very, very heavy stones, and we certainly don't know how you did that.
No.
But compared to a pyramid, pretty boring, isn't it?
Can you name any other famous henges?
Penge henge? I think there's a henge in my back garden. What? Tell me about some other penges. Any other penges?
Penges or henges?
Oh, Steve's put the etymology of penge in the plan.
Oh, really?
Do you want to see that?
Yeah, I'd love etymology.
Okay, well, etymology of penge. Oh, henge. Sorry, not the etymology of
What's
penge.
The etymology of henge?
You find out the etymology of penge, and I'll tell people the etymology of henge. The word henge is a... You've put this in very small there, Steve, haven't you?
Do you want me to read it for you? No.
Hold on, I'll just make it a lot bigger.
There we go. Oh, no, it goes off the page there.
Oh, it goes off the page.
Here's the...
Oh, hold on, I'll just hold my laptop right in front of my face. How about that?
Yeah.
The etymology of henge, the word henge, a back formation from Stonehenge. Oh, it's a kind of backwards compatibility PS5, PS4 sort of deal. Okay, I like that, yeah. The famous monument in Wiltshire. Stonehenge is not a true henge. Holy fucking shit. What are we learning here? Stonehenge isn't even a henge.
It's not even a henge.
But it's the original henge. Very okay. It's as its ditch runs outside of its bank. Although there is a small extant external bank as well. This is thrilling stuff, isn't it? The term was first coined in 1932 by Thomas Kendrick, who later became the keeper of British antiquities at the British Museum.
Do you know what I love about this? There's going to be someone in our comments tomorrow who is an expert in Middle English or something.
That's true.
Tell us about the etymology.
Well, and that's because the audience that we've got for ourselves here, John, very strange people, aren't they? Very very unusual. What are they doing here?
Yeah, you know? That's true.
Why have they flocked to us? We're just mortals, guys.
They're the sort of people who have the time to just build a henge,
men.
Right?
We're just innocent men. We really are. We enjoy all the memes, just like the normal people do.
The name Penge derives from the Celtic word, Celtic word.
Not, it's not the Celtic word, John. Come
it's
on.
It's not Celtic, is it?
Yeah, no. And you should know because you were just on the second captains.
I am.
He's got a football brain, though. It's like,
he's got football
it's
brain.
Like when I studied brain. History, I read Henry, as in the eighth, as Henri in my head.
Did you really? King Henri of England? He had six wives.
Someone in our comments is now going to say, actually, I think we'll find that in that period, Henry was actually pronounced Henri.
And the reason is because they all had bread in their mouths, so the way they spoke at all times was actually dictated by the dryness of the bread. Henri, you know? Yeah, don't send us that.
Celtic comment. Word meaning head of the wood. Pencoed.
A head of the wood.
Pencoed.
What, top wood dog? That was
head of the wood. I think top of the wood.
Yeah, top of the wood. As in, like,
not like the headmaster.
The big wood.
The big, yeah, big dog.
Chris Wood.
Big dog of the wood.
Chris Wood is the original Penge.
That's right.
Okay.
Neither Everton nor Leicester were very good, were they?
No, that's a good way of bringing us back, though.
There's such a miserable picture of Penge.
Is there?
On this. Can I show it to you?
Yeah, I want to see Penge.
Isn't that miserable?
Poundland Penge. Yeah. I mean, I suppose Poundland offers a very real and true service where actually it's not that true because not everything in there is
a
pound.
It's a lie.
It's a lie.
It is a lie.
It's
a lie.
Poundland, for listeners overseas, it's a shop where the name is supposed to indicate that everything inside is a pound or a dollar, but it's not. And this was a boring bit of the podcast, wasn't it, this bit there? Did we go for that? That was boring.
Both teams were very bad, but that made for a really entertaining game,
I thought. Think so?
Yeah.
What was so entertaining about it for you? How bad they were?
Yeah, like neither team really being able to defend properly or attack properly.
Yeah.
I liked Madison's assist for Vardy's goal, like moments of quality in there. But
I think Seb Stafford-Bloor texted me on the day to say something similar to you. He said, the team, the eventual victor will be the team that has the ball last. Because it was very end-to-end.
It was very next goal wins at school kind of vibes. There was an interesting stat that Jamie Carragher analysed before the game on Monday Night Football. I think the amount of goals that Everton have conceded pre and post swapping Connor Cody for Michael Keane has shot up from like 4 to 18 or something.
Well, I mean, also on that note, Opta analyst tweeted about this relating to XG. Leicester had 3.5, Everton had 3.3, and they produced the highest combined XG for a Premier League game this season, 6.8. And it had that feeling about it, didn't it?
And but that's not like two teams at the top of the table with world-class attacks. That's two dreadful defences.
Yeah. Okay, well, listen, the point about this anyway is Leicester and Everton is very possible that if Nottingham Forest are able to escape, one of these two teams might be the team accompanying Southampton and potentially Leeds, maybe, down. Yeah. Is there one amongst these two, Ruben Pinder, that you think might be the more likely? Or do you think they'll both be safe?
I mean, predictions are a bit of a mug's game. I found it difficult to call.
It's good that we've got a mug on the show, though, isn't it? Yeah.
I found it difficult to call yesterday. Just cause they both look like they have kind of the same problems and the same qualities as well. I would probably just about back Everton to survive and Leicester to go down if I had to choose.
Interesting. Based on what?
Dyche. Yeah.
Sure.
And Calvert-Lewin, he's fit again and he looks like he's in decent form. He was threatening quite a lot.
Yeah.
So if he can just stop them from shipping too many goals, drop Michael Keane basically, and get Calvert-Lewin on the end of a couple of crosses, might be enough.
What do you think?
Last roll of the Dyche. Did you know Thomas Crapper? Is a famous
man who invented
notable,
the toilets.
Yeah, well, he's commonly but erroneously credited with inventing the flush toilet.
Really,
he lived in Penge.
Yeah, I did know that. I didn't know he lived in Penge, but I did know about him because very ashamed to say that as a child, I did find it very funny. But as a young teenager, we had a friend in our friend group whose one of their parents, or his mother's maiden name, was Crapper. And we found out about Thomas Crapper, and we used to call this friend of ours Crapper all the time. It really wasn't that funny, but we did it for years. And that's how I know all about Thomas Crapper. So if you're listening, I'm sorry, Crapper. I am. Now, as an adult, I look back on that and I think, well, that was cruel, wasn't it? And it wasn't even that funny. It was a bit funny.
Shit joke.
Exactly. Yeah.
Very good.
Leicester or Everton, though?
Leicester go outside of the relegation zone with that result, right?
So, I believe so, yeah.
Level on
goal difference.
Yeah, right. I'm at the point now where I'm genuinely looking at those teams and thinking, like, could one of these teams, could Leeds feasibly stay up without winning another game?
I mean, yeah.
That's the level that I'm at. In which case, if you can, then surely like Leicester are in a better position to do that than any of the other teams just because of the league position.
Yeah, they've got a marginally easier run-in, I would say.
Tell us the run-ins, Ruben.
So Everton have to go to Brighton. Tough game. Host Man City. Very tough game. Away to Wolves and then home to Bournemouth. So you would think maybe they get 4 points from those four games.
I think four is enough.
And then Leicester, on the other hand, go away to Fulham, then they host Liverpool, away to Newcastle, and then host West Ham. So it's pretty even in terms of how many points you'd expect both teams to get.
If we're consigning Southampton to relegation, which other two teams are going down? Your mug.
Leeds and Leicester.
Okay, John.
Chuckles. I'm in danger.
Yeah.
That's a meme. That's a meme, isn't it?
Uh huh.
I think that...
Just the team names, please.
Forest.
Forest, okay.
And
Just say Leeds. Come on. Just say it out loud.
It's not what you want.
Yeah. Forest and Leeds.
Forest and Leeds.
It's not what you want to happen.
Okay.
I don't even think I believe that, but that's what I'm saying.
I want to hear
what
Steve Hankey thinks. Two team names, please.
He doesn't know that far down the table.
So not this season, no. Southampton, yes. I have to confess a personal interest in Everton Stoke because my dad is an Evertonian.
Right.
But I also think it'll be them.
Yeah, okay.
And probably Leeds.
All the more reason for them to go down, isn't it? Yeah.
No,
and then you can
really
say,
no.
"You fuck you, Dad. I've always hated you."
And yeah, it's also because, I mean, it would, yeah, 1955 would be, that's one of the, Everton as a club historically great. One of the few things they have to hold on to now is the whole consistency of their time in the division. So that would be a new stadium as well coming, possibly in the Championship. Not good.
It's bad. It would
very
be
bad
for them. Yeah. So you think Everton and...
Just the run in and Calvert-Lewin coming back too late.
Which other team, though?
I think Leeds.
Everton and Leeds.
I think
well,
Leeds. Yeah, sorry, John.
It's funny, isn't it? Because like, there's five teams probably who deserve to go down.
Yeah, like, most seasons, really.
If all five of them went down, I don't think anyone would.
I was speaking to my friend in the pub the other day, and we were debating or discussing rather who are the most miserable fan base in the Premier League, and decided that it was a tie between Everton and Spurs. And Everton are essentially a Poundland Spurs, and Spurs are a Waitrose Everton.
Spurs fans have no terrible, right to be miserable, I think.
Of course they do.
No, they
come
don't.
On.
Oh, my God, who are you now? If Seb was here, he'd tell you off for being misery police. Don't tell people what they can't be sad
No, people
about.
Can, people can be miserable.
You said they've got no right to be miserable.
They've got no right to be miserable about the things they're miserable about.
Nonsense. It's all contextual, isn't it?
It's all relative.
It is all relative, but they of all of the relativities, they have the smallest relativity to be miserable.
That's not how relativity works.
Yes, it is.
No, it's not.
I've read Einstein.
No, you haven't. And if you did, it was in Latin and you didn't really understand it. Anyway, let's have another break. And when we come back, we'll wrap this up really quickly so I can go and do my actual job. Returning Liverpool 4-3 Tottenham Hotspur. Now, this was quite funny, wasn't it? Not if you're a Spurs fan, but just objectively, the notion of going 3-0 down and then working your way back to 3-3 to have your equalising goal scorer take a shirt off and, you know, reasonably celebrate with due justification and joy, and then just concede a fourth moments later and lose the game as though you might as well not have bothered doing any of that.
Completely self-inflicted that fourth goal as well.
Yeah. I mean, it was funny. There were several funny moments in this game. Also, Van Dijk getting completely done by Perisic was amusing. But a lot of goals, Ruben Pinder. And there have been more goals than usual this year.
Yeah, it's been a very goaly season, hasn't it? There was 2 4-3s this weekend, this being the main one. It felt like there are kind of two versions of Liverpool, as we've discussed before, and they kind of both turned up at different points in this game. Spurs showed that they can be good. Like the move for Kane's first goal, the pass from Skip down the left to Perisic just before he turned Van Dijk inside out, thought it was really nice football.
Mm-hmm.
But then equally defensively, they just get cut open like butter sometimes. And
they were both shocking at times.
Yeah, and the back three get dragged to the wrong side of the pitch and you end up with Davies on the right and Dier on the left and Romero not knowing where he's going.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it made for a very entertaining watch, though.
It did indeed. And John McKenzie, I mean, it's worth saying that Tottenham Hotspur played Manchester United midweek last week too, a game that you text me during to say... What did you say again? You hate it. I hate this. Is this even football?
Did I say that?
I think
that
you said something, like that, yeah.
I'm almost tempted to... I don't have my phone on me, so I can't...
Do you want me to find out what you're talking about? But Spurs, you know, just defensively. Yeah. I mean, Liverpool as well, but Spurs specifically.
So both of these teams in this game, I think, were doing the things that they're famous for doing well, badly, if that makes sense. So Spurs are famous for playing like with a back three, low block, counter, and some of the things that they were doing defensively were just absolutely abject. So the first goal... Pedro Porro and completely unmarking or dismarking or not even realizing that he's in the same postcode as let me finish this and then you can have your fun.
Go on.
Completely different postcode to Curtis Jones, who then nips in at the back post. And that's just for me that sort of situation is what Spurs have been playing with the back threes for years under managers who are really smart managers, who are really clear about what they want their teams to do in those situations. And it was just an example of players not knowing what they were doing in the situation. Yeah, you just kind of think, how on earth can you not know this? Mm. You've been doing this for... I mean, it's Pedro Porro, so he's a new player, but even still, it's...
It wasn't even like they were outnumbered. Like Liverpool hadn't necessarily dragged their entire defence to one side of pitch where it created like this overload. They had enough players to mark those Liverpool players, and they just didn't.
Yeah. And so there's a few examples of that early on from Spurs, and then Liverpool did the thing that they do where they don't bother marking the player on the ball after having a really aggressive pressing situation which pulls all of their central midfielders across, and then having the most flimsy and simultaneously aggressive back line of all time as well, which just gets played through with a simple pass that any Premier League footballer could play.
It felt a bit like both teams are kind of stuck between two tactical identities at the moment, where fans want pressure on the ball at every level and like more intense high block or whatever you call it. Yeah. But then their gaps open up in between, and then it exposes both defences, which maybe wouldn't look as flimsy if there was more cohesion throughout the whole team.
I think the irony is that if Spurs played like Liverpool usually play and Liverpool played like Spurs usually play, that game would have probably been a 0-0 draw, which is weird, right?
Yeah. No, that's true. Here's what you said.
Anyway, I think we should carry on talking about the football.
Now, this was on Thursday.
This was about conversation about football between me and Ruben.
About the Man United Tottenham game. This is John's WhatsApps in the Tifo group. He said, and to be clear, this is Seb and JJ, Steve Hankey's in there too. But it's a small group where you feel free and willing to say.
Well, no longer do I feel free and willing.
The quality of Spurs United game is abysmal, you said. Maybe it's just last night making things look worse. Last night, of course, you're referring to the Arsenal-Man City game. Seb asks, what were you expecting? You said, more fool me, but something resembling professional football, I guess. You went on to say, what happened to football as an end in itself? So bad, I'm crying. Hold on. So bad, I'm crying. Then you said, I've switched to Everton, Newcastle. Spurs United can't hurt me anymore. And then you said, later, I'm back on the Spurs United game and it's still hurting me. And to finish, you sent a comment there saying, the quality of this game is mind-boggling. That's what you said.
Did you at least catch Alexander Isak's beautiful assist in that Newcastle Everton?
I didn't catch that.
That was terrific, though, wasn't it?
Stunning, yeah.
Really good. Well done.
He's good.
Well done to everyone involved. Just Isak.
Apart from the defenders in that situation.
Apart from the defenders, no. Yeah. No, they got. I would say they got done fairly.
I don't know, man.
The quality of a dribble where I think if you get done by that, you sort of go, yeah, fair enough. You know, happens. What can you do? What can be expected of me? Something resembling a professional footballer? Not
more
I.
More fool you.
Exactly, yeah.
Somebody should have kicked him.
Spurs have conceded a league-high 13 goals in the opening 15 minutes of Premier League matches this season, while only three teams have ever conceded more in this period in a single campaign. That is according to Opta Joe. They've had a tough run. I mean, the three that was added against Liverpool probably pushed them up there.
Even under Conte, they always used to start badly. They wouldn't always concede loads of goals in like the first 20 minutes, but they used to start really slowly and then kind of come out and attack a bit more in the second half. But now it feels like they've gone even further back, where they just don't bother defending for the first 20 minutes and then have to make up for it. For all the chat about Spurs' mental fragility or supposed mental fragility and then not being winners and stuff, the draw against United and bringing this game back to 3-3, I know they did lose it 4-3 in the end due to one brain fart from Lucas Moura, for which Romero and Dyer could have been more alert. But the fact that they did get it back to 3-3 does show some mental resolve.
Absolutely. Right? Yeah, I mean, what is Ryan Mason saying to these guys at halftime? Also, just a quick note, Ryan Mason, the Premier League's best dressed manager? Yeah?
Club shop hoodie.
Yeah.
Well, it's the sort of thing you would wear. So
that's exactly why I'm saying. I look at him and I think, hey, kindred spirits.
When they were 3-0 down in however many minutes it was, my flatmate Henry said to me, oh, it just looks like they've got a fan out of the stands to coach this game.
Yeah, well, because of the informal dress.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, sure. We don't really have time to talk about this anymore, but there'll be five more episodes of the Tifo Football Podcast in which we can discuss Spurs and Liverpool Even indeed Chelsea, because I said at the beginning we were going to talk about Pochettino. We're not going to do that in depth. And the really big news, the good news, the great news, the terrific news is that that was very China, wasn't it? It's great news. The terrific news.
You've just read an Opta tweet which ends with, you know how they do that thing which is almost
one
like
word.
One word at the end, which Sleepy. Is like what Trump does as well. Yeah. It's like sad.
One word, sad. China. But the good thing about China is that next season, of course, the new Tifa Football Podcast will be so in depth as to give you all the juicy details that you need. It's got nothing to do with China. I don't know why you're looking at me quizzically, Steve. It's not coming back to the China comment. And, you know, within that, there'll be a lot of fine episodes on Spurs, Liverpool, Chelsea and more.
Well, we'll have a whole episode dedicated to what went wrong at Spurs. That kind of
indeed,
thing.
Yeah.
You wouldn't want to listen to a whole hour on that.
I think Spurs fans. Yeah. Manchester United,
they don't deserve to be miserable, man.
Manchester United 1-0 Aston Villa. A quick stop here to say very impressive work from Manchester United there, beating, of course, the second best team in the Premier League. What a shame for the second best team in the Premier League there. But over to Italy now. Roma 1-1 Milan. Nobody here watched this game, but I bring it up.
I watched this game.
You said that you didn't. He said that he didn't he? Steve, Hank, I'm not making that up. He said, no, I didn't.
Why would I lie to you about this?
I don't know, but it's like you're gaslighting me. He said that he didn't.
How's it feel the other way around?
You said he did?
I can't remember if he did, actually.
He said he didn't.
I don't want
to... What's he getting at? Did he talk about it to Ken Early? Did you talk about it on Second Captains?
Ken asked me to watch it, so I watched it for him.
I said I hadn't watched it.
You said that.
Potentially confusing.
Was he there? I don't think I'd confuse the two of you. I like you.
Thanks, mate.
Anyway, the point is to say that Roma went ahead in the 94th minute through a goal from Tammy Abraham. But Milan's Salamakers brought it back in 97 minutes. And it's a very important game for the Champions League race there, isn't it, John?
Yeah, Mourinho proving that he's still Spursy as well, which is nice. But yeah, very important because there's three teams on 57 points. So Milan, who are in fourth place, Inter Milan, sorry. It's not Inter Milan.
Just call them Inter.
Yeah, says Inter on our Inter Milan on our table. So.
Yeah.
And then AC Milan, and then Roma, they're all on 57 points in fourth, fifth, and sixth. So they're all trying to get that last Champions League spot. But Atalanta
55 as well.
Coming up from
all
behind.
The more interesting by Juventus getting their points back.
Yeah, well, could they have them taken away again, though, before the end of the season? That is a possibility, isn't it?
That would be nuts, wouldn't it?
I thought it was possible that could happen.
Well, the possible thing that can happen is that Juventus could lose a game and three of the other teams could win the game with 3 points behind them, and then
that could happen. What other possible things could happen?
The world could end, and we would realise very quickly.
Napoli could still not win the league.
Well, that is possible, but didn't you put something interesting in the thread about this morning? That
about
they
the Napoli game?
Talked about on the Totally Show.
So it would be level on points if they didn't win.
The geological...
Yeah, I saw it in the notes for the Totally Show. Let me just read it out. Napoli didn't find out their game had been moved to the Sunday until Saturday morning. I think it got moved so that they would know if they were playing for the title or not. They ended up drawing against Lazio. Environmentalists were worried the Scudetto celebrations would spill out onto the borders of Vesuvius and fans would deliberately provoke an eruption. There was a very small earthquake when Napoli scored.
I mean, it's terrifying, isn't it?
Can we go with a camera for when they do win the league?
Yeah. I watched a video the other day of someone pushing a large boulder into a volcano.
A large boulder the size of a small boulder.
Yeah. That's right, yeah. And it smashed a little bit of the crust at the top, and it caused an eruption to begin.
Volcanoes are cool, aren't they?
I mean,
terrifying, but
scary.
Pretty cool.
Yeah, scary.
I remember listening to the Napoli Milan game that was just happened in the Champions League, and it was Martin Keown and someone else doing the commentary, and they spent a long time talking about the volcano.
Did they?
They're like, oh, well, yeah, we hope it doesn't erupt. But I just had this idea of Martin Keown and the commentator just having being found in 3,000 years' time, huddled around a microphone because Mount Vesuvius had erupted.
Here, children, look at the famous old sports commentator. What's that? Oh, that's when they talked about what was happening.
It's pretty bonkers that you can, like, provoke an eruption.
Yeah.
With human behaviour.
That's true. What happens in my house.
Say,
you know?
Hey, long
when I'm in the toilet on my own doing a poo. Yeah.
I was
anyway.
Say, it was a good TIFO IRL YouTube head. Like, we provoked a We went to Napoli to watch
the earthquake. That is a good headline. Yeah.
The gang provoke an earthquake.
A question before we all go: if you were to be trapped in a lava spill and you knew there's no hope of survival, all you have is the ability to cast one final stance, so you'll be preserved in. Not a sort of political stance. Not saying like I support racism before the lava gets you. But and of course that wouldn't be a political stance. That would be a human rights infringement. But if you have the physical stance, you know, what if you knew you were going to be discovered 3,000 years later? How would you want them to find you?
I would do a dab.
A dab, yeah.
I'd do a dab.
A very culturally significant body movement of our time.
Well,
the
exactly.
Dab.
I'm thinking of the historians or whatever the word is, yes. Archaeologists,
yes.
Who you know dig me up in thousands of years and go, the dab.
Yeah,
a man probably went to university in 2016 if he was doing that. There you go.
What's more likely is that the scientists will go, yes, and here's an example. It shows you how bright the eruption was because, of course, this man put his hand over his face.
He was sneezing
when it was done. What about you?
I don't know, probably like a classic football celebration.
Yeah.
So you're like, doing the Shearer.
You put the whisper on the lips.
Yeah. Maybe both ears.
I think that's better because if you isolate a finger, it's more likely to break off.
Yeah.
You know, I think you need to be sort of in
bigger
chunks.
Keep my hands together. You need to think about the structural integrity of my stance.
That's right, yeah.
So Juventus.
What about Juventus?
Late May is the appeal to the appeal.
Yes.
In terms of their point. Yeah, the Messi appeal. In terms of their point deduction being reinstated.
Right.
What I'm literally looking at as we go is whether, late May is what they say, the Serie A season ends on the 28th of May. So it is possible, depending on how late is late in May, that 15 points penalty is reinstated.
It could happen.
Literally right at the end of the season for Juventus.
It could happen.
That would be very, very funny.
To be honest, even if it happened over the summer, though, it would still mean that the team that finished fifth then finished fourth, right? So from a results perspective, it is all still possible. But my main thought is Inception was confusing enough. I'm not sure I could watch it in Italian. That would be... That's real troubling, isn't it?
What's the word for inception in Italian?
Inzione. You think that's fine to put on a podcast?
It probably is.
Probably is.
Because nouns that end in ION are quite often very similar across.
John's about to find out.
Inizio.
Inizio. Oh, that's better. That's better, isn't it? Yeah. Okay, well, that seems like that's the end of the podcast today. Ruben the baby boy Pinder, happy birthday.
Thank you very much.
Well done on reaching the ripe old age of 27.
Thank you.
Yeah. Jonathan Dog McKenzie, ruff ruff.
Ruff ruff.
There he goes. There he goes. It never fails to please me. It doesn't.
You have to greet all of the future guests of the new format like that.
On the new serious Super Football podcast, I'm joined today by Anne Widdicombe. I don't know why Anne Widdicombe came to my head. She's here to talk to me about football in the 1880s.
Famous Billericay Town supporter.
That's right, yeah.
Get her and Tamplin on the same episode. Gold.
Steve Hankey, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
And to producer Don also. Enjoyed your time today.
Okay.
There he goes, fine. We'll be back next week, where not even a coronation can stand in our way producing and presenting high-quality football coverage. Etymological football coverage for you and all of your royal needs. But until then, bienvenue, au revoir, ta-ta, as they'll say at the coronation, and auf Wiedersehen. Yes?
Yes.
Yes.
The Athletic.